Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. A Fine Time for Healing is now sponsored by Massage Envy. Massage Envy is continually looking to evolve your total body care experience by enhancing your personal wellness through innovation and personalization. There has been a wide variety of research proving the benefits of massage therapy for everyday wellness and various conditions. Massage Envy is also the number one skincare provider in the United States, offering a large variety of facials and skincare treatments. With over 1,100 clinics across the United States, you are sure to find one conveniently located to wherever you are. Only in her early 30s, today's special guest, Jane McClellan, was given everyone's worst nightmare, a three-month death sentence, stage 4 cervical cancer. The subsequent huge doses of conventional treatment would later also lead to leukemia. Cancers are extremely aggressive and acknowledged to be 100% fatal. In this truly groundbreaking book, Jane takes us through her remarkable, heartbreaking journey and the medical discoveries she made on the way. Using herself as a human guinea pig, she worked out the best drugs and supplements to starve her own cancer in an easy-to-follow metro map. This is a compelling story of resilience and determination in the face of impossible odds that will answer all the burning questions you face when you begin to explore complementary cancer care. And now, I'm pleased to introduce you to my guest today, Jane McClellan. Good morning, Jane.
Hi. Afternoon here in London.
Yes, Jane is calling from the UK, London. Good, and I can hear you now. So Jane had some trouble connecting because I'm not in London. I'm in the United States. So we finally figured it out this morning. But anyway, so glad you could be with us. Jane, start by telling us why you wrote this book, and then you can tell us your story.
Yeah. I seem to have figured out a way. I've kind of worked out all the fuel lines that cancer uses to feed itself. And I've done this with a huge amount of research, and I have a scientific background. I trained as a physiotherapist, but I've always been very interested in the science and how, you know, essentially about metabolism and how the body works as well. So this, as soon as I was diagnosed with stage four, I went headlong into research. But it was more at the time, it was just looking for anything that might save my life. You know, I wasn't looking for a cure. I wasn't looking for anything that was going to sort of completely reverse it. I was just trying to buy myself some time because I was hanging on by my fingertips at the time. So, and the reason I've written the book is because there is now an explosion of research in the published medical articles about off-label drugs or repurposed drugs. These are old drugs that have been used for other indications, such as metformin for diabetes, statins for cholesterol. Those two in particular have huge benefits. You've got to use the right statin, but these, you know, those two, and there are others, doxycycline, mebendazole, I used one called dipridamole. All of these old drugs have got anti-cancer effects because these drugs are known as dirty, because when they were developed, they didn't just target one thing. They kind of had a multitude of targets in the body. So they weren't just, you know, the doxycycline, for example, isn't just going to attack an infection. It actually has an effect on the mitochondria in your cells as well. And this is the same for many old drugs, which, you know, the more recent drugs have become more and more specific, but the old ones in particular, and great for the cancer patient, because these are all mostly off patent now and they're cheap, although I rather suspect there will be a price hike when this catches on a bit more. But there are a lot of old drugs that are around that are actually very useful and have an effect on the metabolism of cancer. And this is the area that has been kind of ignored by the medical community. They've been focusing purely on the genetics and the DNA and the, you know, this rapid proliferation of cells. And they've kind of ignored the cancer stem cell, which they only discovered back in the 1990s. But this has a much slower metabolism and it's not killed off by chemo or radiotherapy. And these are the really dangerous cells that get left behind. And they're the ones that you really need to target if you want to eradicate cancer completely. So my book really is just to try and educate people, but not just the patient. This is for educating the oncologists as well. So, you know, because there's a massive gap of knowledge and I'm trying to plug it. So that's my goal, is to try and educate not just the patient, but to actually reach out to doctors as well.
And in this book, How to Starve Cancer, you really walk us through the journey of your trial and errors of all the different medications and things that you tried, what worked, what didn't. And in the end, you have really a formula for how to do this, which is wonderful.
It is kind of formulaic, but I don't want it to be completely formulaic because it's, you know, it depends on the type of cancer that you have, and they all have slightly different feeding mechanisms, but I've kind of written out a map so that you can kind of look up your own cancer on PubMed and try and work out the right fuel lines that you need to block, because currently the oncologists are not addressing that at all.
Right. Okay, thanks for clarifying that. So we're going to call it a map more than a formula. So
yeah. Well, yeah.
I want to back up a little bit. And when you first found out you had cancer, you had already been told that you didn't by a doctor, right, or other doctors?
For a long time.
And that was a problem. That was a serious problem. So can you explain that, what happened?
I had all the usual. I was quite diligent in that I kept on going back for my smears, and I ended up having a colposcopy, and I kept on being told that there was nothing wrong and that it was all clear, and I had nothing to worry about. But actually it ended up that he was a bit of a rogue doctor, and there was a national inquiry about him, the results of which I've still yet to see, actually. I'm going to request through the Freedom of Information Act to actually see the results of that inquiry, because it's been hidden very nicely by the NHS in England. But this guy was a bit of a rogue doctor, and unfortunately, I fell through the gaps, and I was mistreated, misdiagnosed, and I ended up having, at the time, it had, you know, when it was first discovered, and I went privately. I ignored the NHS eventually. I had to go private because I just wasn't getting anywhere. They discovered it had already gone to my lymph nodes, and so it was quite an advanced stage by the time it was diagnosed. But that was my initial diagnosis, and then a few years later, it then spread to my lungs. So that was a really scary bit.
Oh, I'll bet it was scary. You say only hours into your diagnosis, you were realizing that cancer's effects extended far beyond physical illness. So when you say that, what are some of the things that we experience with this in the beginning?
It's actually like going through trauma of an emotional trauma. And I think actually after that, I suffered post-traumatic stress disorder, and I was certainly extremely depressed because I was only 30 years old, and I had a radical hysterectomy. I had radiotherapy, which blasted my ovaries. So I was effectively sterile from that moment on. And I just started a relationship with my now husband. And we were only two months into our relationship. And this was incredibly hard for both of us to deal with. So it wasn't just me trying to deal with this. He had to do some serious hard thinking as to whether he wanted to stay with me. It was a very, very traumatic experience. So it wasn't just, you know, the physical side was bad enough. The emotional side was truly quite devastating. And I was very, very depressed for many years because I wasn't that concerned about dying when I was first diagnosed. I kind of thought I would be cured, and I didn't really expect it to come back at that point. But I think probably my depression and my grief, because I was suffering enormous grief, not just losing my future children. It was also that I was grieving that I was never going to be the same person ever again. So that there is a lot of emotional baggage that comes with cancer. And also, you know, you end up with scars. I've ended up with lymphedema in my leg. The chemotherapy has left me probably with some mild heart problems. I've got immune dysfunction as a result of the chemo as well, which means I have to keep on trying to work on my immune system to keep it up. And I've got sort of long-term lung damage. So there's a whole issue of all these other effects that go with cancer, which aren't immediately anything that you kind of think about. And you know, people just assume that cancer is a lump, it can be cut out, and then you carry on with your life. It really isn't like that at all, because there are so many different aspects to it. I mean, some people get a lump and they get it cut out and they're absolutely fine, you know, and that's great for them. But for me, it was far more devastating on many more fronts.
It sounds so so difficult. What a difficult process to go through. I can't even imagine it. Thank God I've never had to experience that with myself or anything. It's really awful. It's awful. In your book, you talk about the effect of glucose on cancer cells, and I'd like for you to share more about that.
Okay. Well, glucose is well known to be the main fuel for cancer. In fact, actually, cancer has other fuels as well. It can use fatty acids. It can use glutamine, which is a kind of protein. And it can actually use ketones. I know a lot of people go on the ketogenic diet, but they've got to be wary of the fact that it can use ketones. Glucose is the sort of the main one for most cancers. They do thrive heavily on glucose, and actually just cutting that down with a low GI diet can make quite a big difference. It's not enough to just go through a sort of, you know, low GI diet, and that's something that I discovered. I did the low GI diet, and I also added lots of supplements. I did intravenous vitamin C, but the reason that glucose specifically is kind of needed because the cancer cell, all of them, the fast dividing cell and the stem cell, kind of need a lot of energy. And to carry on with this rapid replication, you know, the creation of their daughter cells all the time, that requires a huge amount of energy. And to get that, you know, they have a big appetite for glucose. And if they can't get enough glucose, they will use the glutamine or the fatty acids, whatever they can, frankly, grab hold of to convert into energy to continue this rapid replication. But the cancer cell will create more glucose receptors on its surface to attract glucose to it, and insulin helps push it in. So you need to be keeping insulin levels sort of low. You need to be keeping glucose levels low. And the glucose kind of fuels a different kind of process in the cancer cell. This was discovered in the 1920s by a German physicist called Otto Warburg, who discovered that cancer cells do this a kind of fermenting process called glycolysis. And this is very different to the normal kind of ATP production in the mitochondria. This is not happening in the little organelles that look a bit like bacteria in our cells. This is actually happening in the cytoplasm of the cell outside of the nucleus and the mitochondria. This is in the sort of more of the area outside of that. And it's creating this, it produces lactate actually by doing this particular inefficient mechanism. But it just uses anything it possibly can actually to create as much energy as it can. So it uses glycolysis. And then it also, if it can't get enough fuel doing that, it then upregulates more of the mitochondria. So it becomes supercharged. This is kind of what happens to the cancer cells, is they become more electrically, everything just goes slightly haywire, electrically, you know, metabolically, chemically, everything is just go forward. So it's really creating quite a rapid replication because of all of this activity going on in the cell. And this is all fueled by mostly glucose, but other substrates as well. And this is the point. It's not just about glucose.
Right. And I wanted to touch on different things, but I wanted to ask you, because you talk about how some doctors say to cut out sugar, but then they say honey is okay. So what are some of the forms of glucose that we would eat normally? So we can recognize what to cut out.
Unfortunately, you know, I mean, this is the kind of problem, is that this was thought, you know, honey was thought to be okay, and actually it isn't, sadly, I'm afraid. You know, if you have an advanced, maybe if you've got a sort of a low-grade cancer, then you might be able to get away with it. But if you got a high-grade cancer, I wouldn't. You need to be very careful until you get rid of it. You need to be very careful about adding honey or anything that's high glycemic. And that's the point. It sort of releases a lot of glucose quickly. What you want is slow burn carbs rather than the ones that release glucose quickly. And one of the worst offenders for that is actually wheat or bread. So actually put that in your mouth, and that is converted by amylase, which is the enzyme in the mouth. And this actually produces, it actually converts to glucose faster than sugar. So it's actually one of the worst culprits, I'm afraid, is white bread. So it's a tricky one. There are quite a few things out there, and things like fried potatoes, because it's high carb, but it's actually the frying can actually, and the heat can actually make it convert much quicker. So it's not just about what you eat, it's actually how you cook it. And also, you know, and there are some good websites to look up the sort of glycemic index, which is how quickly a food will release glucose. And this is, you know, diabetics need to know this kind of information. And actually, I think cancer patients should all effectively treat themselves a bit like a diabetic, in that they need to take glucose lowering supplements at every meal. And I suggest to some of them that they even test their glucose levels like a diabetic after they've eaten, just so that they know how much glucose has been released into their system and how much work the body's trying to do to try and cope with that, because it's not good for anybody to have a huge amount of sugar running around your system.
Right. Thank you.
Like
Thank you for explaining that. That really helps us to understand. One of the first things that you realized about cancer was that it causes an inflammatory response to the body. And so you investigated aspirin to try to cut down on the inflammation. So would you please explain what your thought process was and what you found to be true?
Yeah, so aspirin, I went to my surgeon who was about to give me my, he was going to operate on my lungs. This is when I had my secondary, so it had spread to my lungs, and I had a golf ball-sized tumor in my right lung. And he was quite concerned I was going to bleed overnight because he thought it was pressing on a major artery, but I was okay, fortunately. But the I'd been to see him, and this is back in 1999, of course, and even then, there still isn't there much recognition of just how useful aspirin is for cancer. But I mean, there are other anti-inflammatories as well that are useful in different ways. But aspirin is quite a multi-talented little drug, and it's so old and so cheap that it's kind of ignored and forgotten. But I'd come across research that just suggested it was a COX-2 inhibitor, and COX-2 is sort of one of these, well, COX is an inflammatory cytokine that's kind of released when you have cancer. So and it just helps damp down this inflammation, and particularly pre- and post-op, dampening down inflammation is really, really key, and this is something that could be implemented by every single surgeon up and down the country. If they just use more anti-inflammatories, not necessarily aspirin just before, but other ones, because aspirin can actually thin the blood, so you've got to be a little bit careful just before an operation. But I delayed my operation in order to achieve a less inflammatory body before I allowed any surgeon to work on me. So I'd already sort of learned enough to sort of say, right, well, whoa, hold your horses. I'm not going straight in for an operation this time. I'm going to make sure my body is prepared. So I used aspirin, although actually probably a few days before I would have used ibuprofen or another one. In fact, Etodolac is a strong non-steroidal that I actually used later on in my cocktail, my drug cocktail, to try and get rid of the leukemia that was developing. But back when, in 1999, when I was first diagnosed with the lung cancer, aspirin was at that time, you know, the only thing I'd really come across that would help to reduce the inflammation properly or work on some of these factors that seem to be involved with cancer. It's also one of aspirin's great attributes is to actually reduce something called VEGF, which is vascular endothelial growth factor. And this creates a sort of a network of blood vessels around a tumor to feed it. And what aspirin does is it helps to stop produce this little network of blood vessels to feed the cancer. So that, in effect, actually helps to starve it. So it's a different way of starving it than directly stopping the nutrients. But I just later discovered that actually aspirin combined with either metformin or a supplement called berberine will help stop something called fatty acid synthesis. And this is very heavily involved in trying to create new cell membranes and things for the daughter cells. So aspirin is multi-talented and really neglected by the mainstream oncology profession, which is a huge shame.
It's such a simple thing. It's just amazing how doctors are not receptive to these kind of things. But we're dealing with, you're up against Big Pharma, and that's a powerful organization.
They're not terribly keen on my book, I don't think. So I've had some dark forces try and remove my book from the markets and people trying to discredit me. But I've waded my way through all that. I'm still going, so that's fine. So and the
that's amazing. I was going to ask you. I was going to ask you about that because I know that they go after like bulldogs. They go viciously after people who come up with cures.
Threatened tweets. I've had all sorts of things. People threatening legal action, trying to encourage somebody I mentioned in the book because I was on Dragon's Den, which is your equivalent of Shark Tank. Somebody one of the dragons or the sharks on in my book didn't treat me particularly nicely, and I don't. She doesn't come out very favourably in my book.
No, she doesn't.
Get her to defamation and things to try and remove my book. Anyway, that's all gone away. So,
good.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you. I'm glad that you moved through that.
That
and
I won't go there, but it's there are lots of other little attacks on me. But that's
I'm sure.
It, to be honest,
I'm sure of it. So another thing I wanted to ask you was. And I've actually heard this, but you explain it really well in the book. So why don't we or you want to biopsy a cancer cell? What is the risk of biopsying a cancer cell?
Well, it's not very well known, and doctors will deny that this is a problem, but actually biopsies can cause microtrauma to the area and to break the capsule of the actual tumor, and it kind of has a little capsulation around it, and when you start stabbing it you can spread, and it only takes it doesn't take much to spread a few billion cells. You've got about 2 billion or 10 I think it's 10 billion cells at the size of the end of a pencil. Just the lead at the end of a pencil is about 2 billion cells or something. So, it really doesn't take a lot to start spreading rogue cancer cells into the blood system. And a lot of people say that they get cancer recurrence in the area where it's been biopsied or, and this is not recognized. And I was very determined not to have a biopsy done on my lung tumor. They were desperate to go in there and start messing around. And I thought, well, what's the point? Because they're about to take it out anyway. Mm-hmm. Why would they want to go in there, start doing all sorts of biopsies and then operate later? There was made no sense to me. I said, no, look, you just take it out, job done, then it's gone. And we're not, and don't spill any cells when you're doing it. And do that. And they were so adamant that, oh, this is not the protocol. This is not. I said, stuff your protocol. This is what I want to do. Very determined. I just wasn't going to let them do it. There's been a lot of, in fact, I've read I can't remember his name, but he's written he's a scientist, worked in the oncology field for a long time, and he's done a huge amount of research looking into the effects of not just biopsy but actually operations as well, and how they stimulate inflammation and how they can trigger further metastasis. In fact, you actually get a spike in Mets about metastases. These are the sort of the distant tumors about 10 or 11 months after either a biopsy or surgery. You get this peak, and this is all caused by the surgery or the biopsy. That little peak is directly linked to the interference of the tumor by surgery. And, this is an area where we could really, really improve survival rates if we just looked at, just stopping this spread, or just looking at doing things just a little bit more carefully, taking a slightly different approach and not haphazardly just, we can just chuck it out, cut it out. That's the way to do it. Look at it far more logically. And treat it with some respect, treat it with some care. Don't go around squishing it in mammograms all the time every year. I'm not completely against mammograms, but I think they can be very misleading and lead to a lot of misdiagnoses and an awful lot of angst, unnecessary angst. And I think there are, it's only one method of looking at a tumor. And I kind of refuse to have my annual, I've had one. And that was under sufferance, I'm not a fan really of mammograms particularly.
I always follow mine up with ultrasound, just because I don't necessarily trust the mammogram. And the ultrasound will show every lump and bump in there. At some point, you decided that the best strategy was to keep the cancer cells in your circulation and not allow them a chance to settle or to cling to the blood vessel linings and set up camp somewhere else in your body. Is this what is called metastasizing?
Yes. Exactly, and that's what it does. It kind of travels in platelet clumps and sort of travels around the body and then settles somewhere. And it also travels with a lump of fat to kind of feed itself. So it's like a traveling, it's like a traveler, a nomad waiting to find somewhere. You know, traveling with its own fuel supply. But what you can do is use aspirin. You see, aspirin is so simple, but it helps to break up these platelets and it allows the immune system to see the cancer cell whizzing around your system rather than being hidden in this clump of platelets. And it allows the immune system a chance to attack it. So it's a very simple strategy, but, you know, it can be hugely beneficial. It's not the answer. But it could make a massive difference to anybody who happens to be going through cancer right now. You know, adding a little bit of aspirin, you've got to check. Sometimes with chemo, it's not advisable, or, you know, there are issues with it, particularly if you're sensitive to non-steroidals for your stomach. But, you know, it's such a simple strategy just to employ, and it could be
right.
So beneficial.
And you're not, in your book, you don't say go exclusively holistic. You know, you believe that a combination can be very effective, right? Combination of traditional chemotherapy and along with
people. I'm not religious about sort of doing one thing or another. I'm all about making sure you do what's the best. And sometimes you need a high dose of chemo just as a temporary, you know, hit just to try and reduce the size of the tumor. But it is very destructive on the body. And I think there are better ways to approach most tumors if there's not an immediate urgency to getting rid of it. And most people can actually live with the tumor in their bodies quite happily. In fact, when people are diagnosed with cancer, they've very often been living with it for years and they've not really realized. I mean, most cancers take years to develop. So there isn't this rush that some people fear there is, but unless you've got very aggressive cancer and it's stage 4 or pancreatic or a glioblastoma in the brain or something, in which case that's a different ball of, you know. But anyway, it's mostly you can survive quite happily with a tumor in the body. I'm going to have to cough. I'm sorry. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
But the tumor aren't, you know, mostly they're not as deadly as people make out. So you've got time to address it and use a cocktail. And the point is, by using a cocktail, you can actually reduce the quantity of everything. By using more, you can reduce each of those drugs that you, or supplements even, some of them are very effective. Berberine, for example, is almost as effective, in fact, actually more so in some ways than metformin. So, you know, there are supplements and there are drugs, and the more that you add, the less of each you need. So that's the whole thing, is to use a proper cocktail. And we use a cocktail to try and overcome HIV, and people can live healthy lifespans quite happily with HIV, you know, but we don't have that approach with cancer, because it's a newer, HIV was a newer disease, and everybody was really
right. And that was a wonderful breakthrough. We never thought that there would be a cure for that, and then there was not a cure, but a way to keep it at bay, to maintain it. You said that you emphasize in your book, you know, about starving the cancer cell and diet. And
yes.
You said you hadn't heard the term ketogenic in 1999, but that was something you focused on. So this is the craze right now, the keto diet. How can this help us to prevent or to maintain or cure our cancer? Jane? Jane?
Yes, sorry. I'm so sorry. Somebody keeps trying to call me and it's cutting me off. I do apologize. So, yes, if I just talk about the ketogenic diet very briefly, because people get very religious about the ketogenic diet. And I think actually to start with, it gets you into a good pattern of reducing the glycemic load in the body so that you're not getting that sugar hit. And I think it's quite good training to get you into a better eating pattern. And you can reduce your need for high dose, you know, for those high release glucose hits, the high glycemic carby type foods, by going on a ketogenic diet. So I think initially it's quite a good strategy to sort of go on that kind of diet. In fact, actually fasting might be, you know, a couple of days fasting once you first diagnose might actually be the best thing to do. But it's just to try and stop that sugar getting to the cancer cell, because they're the ones that kind of get fed straight away and the rest of the body gets fed later. So it's trying to deprive the cancer cell first and then allow your body to still receive the nutrients that it needs. But the ketogenic diet long-term hasn't actually had the kind of results they were hoping for. I wouldn't say it's a long-term strategy, because cancer does learn to use ketones. So you've got to learn how to block those pathways as well. And ketones are what, you know, it's alternative fuel to carbs. If you shut down carbs, then you need a certain amount of carbs for your brain. But the brain can actually adapt to using ketones as well.
Okay.
But the cancer cell doesn't, you know, it doesn't like ketones in quite the same way, but it can still, you know, some, in fact, brain tumors do actually use acetate quite heavily, and this is a ketone. And most brain cancer patients have come across good research to say that the ketogenic diet works, but actually long-term it doesn't, because it learns to get around the lack of glucose, which is kind of its main fuel, and then it just starts to use the ketones, becomes more aggressive and harder to treat. So you've got to be wary of that particular aspect of it and know that you've got to block more than just the carb pathway, and you've got to block the keto pathway as well. So whilst
right.
it's useful to get you in a good habit,
right.
I think, you know, it's the point with my book is that I offer people solutions to not just, because people find the ketogenic diet really hard. You know, it's not a long-term strategy. People find it almost impossible to keep the carbs down all the time. And the you know, metformin, which is this old diabetic drug, can really help with that, as does berberine. And this helps, you know, you don't, I mean, I'm not saying you should, you know, you're allowed to cheat going on my protocol, but it just makes it a lot easier. And if you do make some slip ups, it's not the end of the world. Do you know what I mean? You can, you're allowed a few errors here and there. It's not, you know, whereas,
good.
I mean, the cancer thing really is quite a voracious feeder. And starving it really is kind of the key to getting rid of the stem cell, which is ultimately what you need to do to achieve the long-term remission. But the ketogenic is only several strategies, really, of reducing your carbs.
Right. And as I said in the beginning of the show, this is all explained very thoroughly, along with many, many other treatments and supplements and vitamins and certain things that, you know, Jane has tried and some found to be beneficial. And so I want to ask you, Jane, how are you doing these days? How do you feel?
I'm pretty busy, actually. I'm in my health. I'm absolutely fine, but I'm inundated with emails and messages, and I have a Facebook group, which is kind of, it's become a bit of a millstone, frankly, because I like to post on there new research and keep people updated with new ways to try and, you know, starve your cancer, etc. So I've got both my How to Starve Cancer Facebook page, plus I've got one for more off-label drugs, these old drugs that have kind of been forgotten by the industry, or ones they'd rather you didn't know, because they'd much rather you start using their most expensive latest drug. But these old drugs that have been forgotten, you know, there's a whole host of them. There's some very simple ones like mebendazole or fenbendazole, which are both worming drugs. You use mebendazole in the UK here. I don't think you can get it so easily in the US, but fenbendazole is kind of like the vet equivalent. And this has a myriad of effects on various different parts of the cell pathways, from cell signaling to growth factors to the immune system to actually working a bit like a chemotherapy drug. So I'm busy. I'm very busy.
Okay, good. But your health-wise, you're doing great. You're doing great.
Oh, yeah, health-wise, I'm doing
good,
fine.
We're running out of time, so I don't want to interrupt you. I don't want to interrupt you, but we're running out of time. So your book is available on Amazon?
Yes, .com as well as .co.uk. The paperback is, I've just had to do a quick reprint because it sold out so fast. I did a YouTube that people could look up, and it's had, in the last 2 weeks, about 35,000
Awesome.
Already. Yeah.
That's wonderful. So the book is called How to Starve Cancer. We're talking with Jane McClellan. Jane, thank you so much for being my guest today. And the effort that you put into connecting with me today, I really appreciate that. And your information is priceless. So I really, really want to thank you for that.
Okay. And I'm sorry for the interruptions and bad connection.
Yeah, it's kind of hard, you know, when we're doing this far long distance, because we're talking over each other a little bit. But, the interruptions with the calls, it's okay. This is a live show, and live things happen. So that's to be expected. Dogs barking sometimes. When I start a show, that's when they begin mowing my lawn, and it's loud. Yeah, stuff happens. All right, well, I have to say goodbye, but it has been a wonderful, wonderful time talking
to
you.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Do you love this show and want to see it grow to its full potential? A Fine Time for Healing is looking for paid ad sponsors so it can bring you an even better show. For inquiries about ad sponsorship, please email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com. That's RANDIFINE.com. I look forward to hearing from you. And as always, may joy and serenity be yours. Goodbye.